Side 6, The Dark Half, by Stephen King, continuing on page 211. Alan thought maybe the man was still coming. "But none of that answers the question," his mind whispered. "Why are you bothering with all this? Why are you calling Fort Laramie, Wyoming, and chasing down an old doc who probably doesn't remember Thad Beaumont from a hole in the wall?" "Because I don't have anything better to do," he answered himself irritably. "Because I can call from here without the town selectmen bitching about the goddamn long-distance charges. And because they believe it. Thad and Liz. It's crazy, all right, but they seem sane enough otherwise. And goddammit, they believe it. That doesn't mean I do." And he didn't. Did he? The day passed slowly. Dr. Pritchard didn't call back, but the voice prints came in shortly after 8 o'clock, and the voice prints were amazing. 5. They weren't what Thad had expected at all. He had expected a sheet of graph paper covered with spiky mountains and valleys, which Alan would try to explain. He and Liz would nod wisely, as people did when someone was explaining a thing too complex for them to understand, knowing that if they did ask questions, the explanations which followed would be even less comprehensible. Instead, Alan showed them two sheets of plain white paper. A single line ran across the middle of each. There were a few groups of spike points, always in pairs or trios, but for the most part, the lines were peaceful, if rather irregular, sine waves. And you only had to look from one to the other with the naked eye to see that they were either identical or very close to it. "That's it?" Liz asked. "Not quite," Alan said. "Watch." He slid one sheet on top of the other. He did this with the air of a magician performing an exceptionally fine trick. He held the two sheets up to the light. Thad and Liz stared at the doubled sheets. "They really are," Liz said in a soft, awed voice. "They're just the same." "Well, not quite," Alan said, and pointed at three spots where the voice print line on the undersheet showed through the tiniest bit. One of these show-throughs was above the line on the top sheet, the other two below. In all three cases, the show-through was in places where the line spiked. The sine wave itself seemed to match perfectly. "The differences are in Thad's print, and they come only at stress points." Alan tapped each show-through in turn. "Here. What do you want, you son of a bitch? Just what the fuck do you want? And here. That's a goddamn lie, and you know it. And finally here. Quit lying, goddammit. Right now, everyone's focusing on these three minute differences because they want to hang on to their assumption that no two voice prints are ever alike. But the fact is, there weren't any stress points in Stark's part of the conversation. The bastard stayed cool, calm, and collected all the way through." "Yeah," Thad said. He sounded like he was drinking lemonade. Alan put the voice prints down on an end table. "Nobody at State Police Headquarters really believes these are two different voice prints, even with the minute differences," he said. "We got the prints back from Washington very fast. The reason I'm so late is because, after the expert in Augusta saw them, he wanted a copy of the tape. We sent it down on an Eastern Airlines commuter flight out of Bangor, and they ran it through a gadget called an audio enhancer. They use it to tell if someone actually spoke the words under investigation, or if they're listening to a voice which was on tape." "Is it live or is it Memorex?" Thad said. He was sitting by the fireplace drinking a soda. Liz had returned to the playpen after looking at the voice prints. She was sitting cross-legged on the floor trying to keep William and Wendy from wrapping their heads together as they examined each other's toes. "Why did they do that?" Alan cocked a thumb at Thad, who was grinning sourly. "Your husband knows." Thad asked Alan, "With the little differences in the spikes, they can at least kid themselves that two different voices were speaking, even if they know better. That was your point, wasn't it?"
"Uh-huh.
Even though I've never heard of voice prints even remotely as close as these." He shrugged. "Granted, my experience with them isn't as wide as the guys at Fole who study them for a living, or even the guys in Augusta, who are more or less general practitioners. Voice prints, fingerprints, footprints, tire prints. But I do read the literature. And I was there when the results came back, Thad. They are kidding themselves, yes, but they're not doing it very hard."
"So they've got three small differences, but they're not enough.
The problem is that my voice was stressed and Stark's wasn't. So they went to this enhancer thing hoping for a fallback position, hoping, in fact, that Stark's end of the conversation would turn out to be a tape recording made by me. He cocked an eyebrow at Alan. Do I win the stewing chicken? Not only that, you win the glassware for 6 and the free trip to Kittery. That's the craziest thing I ever heard, Liz said flatly. Fad laughed without much humor. The whole thing is crazy. They thought I might have changed my voice, like Rich Little or Mel Blanc. The idea is that I made a tape in my George Stark voice, building in pauses where I could reply, in front of witnesses, in my own voice. Of course, I'd have to buy a gadget that could hook a cassette tape recorder into a pay telephone. There are such things, aren't there, Alan? You bet. Available at fine electronic supply houses everywhere. Or just dial the 800 number that will appear on your screen. Operators are standing by. Right. The only other thing I'd need would be an accomplice. Someone I trusted who would go to Penn Station, attach the tape player to a phone in the bank which looked like it was doing the least business, and dial my house at the proper time. Then, he broke off. How was the call paid for? I forgot about that. It wasn't collect. Your telephone credit card number was used, Alan said. You obviously gave it to your accomplice. Yeah, obviously. I only had to do 2 things once this shuck and jive got started. One was to make sure I answered the telephone myself. The other was to remember my lines and plug them into the correct pauses. I did very well, wouldn't you say, Alan? Yeah, fantastic. My accomplice hangs up the telephone when the script says he should. He unhooks the tape player from the phone, tucks it under his arm. Hell, slips it into his pocket, Alan said. The stuff they've got now is so good even the CIA buys at Radio Shack. Okay, he slips it into his pocket and just walks away. The result is a conversation where I am both seen and heard to be talking to a man 500 miles away, a man who sounds different, who sounds, in fact, just the tiniest bit southern fried, but has the same voice print as I do. It's the fingerprints all over again, only better. He looked at Alan for confirmation. On second thought, Alan said, make that an all-expense-paid trip to Portsmouth. Thank you. Don't mention it. That's not just crazy, Liz said. It's utterly incredible. I think all those people should have their heads. While her attention was diverted, the twins finally succeeded in knocking their own heads together and began to cry lustily. Liz picked up William, Thad rescued Wendy. When the crisis passed, Alan said, It's incredible, all right. You know it, I know it, and they know it too. But Conan Doyle had Sherlock Holmes say at least one thing that still holds true in crime detection. When you eliminate all the impossible explanations, whatever is left is your answer, no matter how improbable it may be. I think the original was a little more elegant, Thad said. Alan grinned. Screw you. You two may find this funny, but I don't, Liz said. Thad would have to be crazy to do something like that. Of course, the police may think we're both crazy. They don't think any such thing, Alan replied gravely. At least not at this point. And they won't, as long as you go on keeping your wilder tales to yourselves. What about you, Alan? Thad asked. We've spilled all the wild tales to you. What do you think? Not that you're crazy. All of this would be a lot simpler if I did believe it. I don't know what's going on. What did you get from Dr. Hume? Liz wanted to know. The name of the doctor who operated on Thad when he was a kid, Alan said. It's Hugh Pritchard. Does that ring a bell, Thad? Thad frowned and thought it over. At last he said, I think it does, but I might only be kidding myself. It was a long time ago. Liz was leaning forward, bright-eyed. William goggled at Alan from the safety of his mother's lap. What did Pritchard tell you? She asked. Nothing. I got his answering machine, which allows me to deduce that the man is still alive, and that's all. I left a message. Liz settled back in her chair, clearly disappointed. What about my tests? Thad asked. Did Hume have anything back, or wouldn't he tell you? He said that when he had the results, you'd be the first to know, Alan said. He grinned. Dr. Hume seemed rather offended at the idea of telling a county sheriff anything. That's George Hume, Thad said and smiled. Crusty is his middle name. Alan shifted in his seat. Would you like something to drink, Alan? Liz asked. A beer or a Pepsi? No, thanks. Let's go back to what the state police do and do not believe. They don't believe either of you is involved, but they reserve the right to believe you might be. They know they can't hang last night's and this morning's work on you, Thad. An accomplice, maybe. The same one, hypothetically, who would have worked the tape recorder gag. But not you. You were here. What about Darla Gates? Thad asked quietly. The girl who worked in the controller's office. Dead. Mutilated pretty badly, as he suggested. But shot once through the head first. She didn't suffer. That's a lie. Alan blinked at him. He didn't let her off so cheaply. Not after what he did to Clausen. After all, she was the original stoolie, wasn't she? Clausen dangled some money in front of her. It couldn't have been very much, judging from the state of Clausen's finances, and she obliged by letting the cat out of the bag. So don't tell me he shot her before he cut her, and that she didn't suffer. All right, Alan said. It wasn't like that. Do you want to know how it really was? No, Liz said immediately. There was a moment of heavy silence in the room. Even the twins seemed to feel it. They looked at each other with what seemed to be great solemnity. At last Thad asked, Let me ask you again, what do you believe? What do you believe now? I don't have a theory. I know you didn't tape Stark's end of the conversation, because the enhancer didn't detect any tape hiss. And when you jack up the audio, you can hear the Penn Station loudspeaker announcing that the Pilgrim to Boston is now ready for boarding on track number 3. The Pilgrim did board on track 3 this afternoon. Boarding started at 2:36 p.m., and that's right in line with your little chat. But I didn't even need that. If the conversation had been taped on Stark's end, either you or Liz would have asked me what the enhancing process showed as soon as I brought it up. Neither of you did. All this, and you still don't believe it, do you? Thad said. I mean, it's got you rocking and rolling, enough so you really are trying to chase down Dr. Pritchard. But you really can't get all the way to the middle of what's happening, can you? He sounded frustrated and harried even to himself. The guy himself admitted he wasn't Stark. Oh, yes, he was very sincere about it, too, Thad laughed. You act as though that doesn't surprise you. It doesn't. Does it surprise you? Frankly, yes, it does. After going to such great pains to establish the fact that you and he share the same fingerprints, the same voice prints. Alan, stop a second, Thad said. Alan did, looking at Thad inquiringly. I told you this morning that I thought George Stark was doing these things. Not an accomplice of mine, not a psycho who has somehow managed to invent a way to wear other people's fingerprints. Between his murderous fits and identity fugues, that is. And you didn't believe me. Do you now? No, Thad. I wish I could tell you differently, but the best I can do is this. I believe that you believe. He shifted his gaze to take in Liz. Both of you. I'll settle for the truth, since anything less is apt to get me killed, Thad said, and my family along with me, more likely than not. At this point, it does my heart good just to hear you say you don't have a theory. It's not much, but it's a step forward. What I was trying to show you is that the fingerprints and voice prints don't make a difference, and Stark knows it. You can talk all you want about throwing away the impossible and accepting whatever is left, no matter how improbable, but it doesn't work that way. You don't accept Stark, and he's what's left when you eliminate the rest. Let me put it this way, Alan. If you had this much evidence of a tumor in your brain, you would go into the hospital and have an operation, even if the odds were good you'd not come out alive. Alan opened his mouth, shook his head, and snapped it shut again. Other than the clock and the soft babble and coo of the twins, there was no sound in the living room where Thad was rapidly coming to feel he had spent his entire adult life. On one hand, you have enough hard evidence to make a strong circumstantial court case, Thad resumed softly. On the other, you have the unsubstantiated assertion of a voice on the phone that he's come to his senses, that he knows who he is now. Yet you're going to ignore the evidence in favor of the assertion. No, Thad, that's not true. I'm not accepting any assertions right now, not yours, not your wife's, and least of all the ones made by the man who called on the phone. All my options are still open. Thad jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the window. Beyond the gently wavering drapes, they could see the state police car that belonged to the troopers who were watching the Beaumont house. What about them? Are all their options still open? I wish to Christ you were staying here, Alan. I'd take you over an army of state troopers, because you've at least got one eye half open. Theirs are stuck shut. Thad. Never mind, Thad said. It's true, you know it. And he knows it, too. He'll wait. And when everybody decides it's over and the Beaumonts are safe, when all the police fold their tents and move on, George Stark will come here. He paused, his face a dark and complicated study. Alan saw regret, determination, and fear at work in that face. I'm going to tell you something now. I'm going to tell both of you. I know exactly what he wants. He wants me to write another novel under the Stark byline. Probably another novel about Alexis Machine. I don't know if I could do that. But if I thought it would do any good, I'd try. I'd trash the Golden Dog and start tonight. Thad, no, Liz cried. Don't worry, he said. It would kill me. Don't ask me how I know that. I just do. But if my death was the end of it, I still might try. But I don't think it would be, because I don't really think he is a man at all. Alan was silent. So, Thad said, speaking with the air of a man bringing an important piece of business to a close. That's where matters stand. I can't, I won't, I mustn't. That means he'll come. And when he comes, God knows what will happen. Thad, Alan said uncomfortably, you need a little perspective on this, that's all. And when you get it, most of it will just blow away. Like a milkweed puff, like a bad dream in the morning. It isn't perspective we need, Liz said. They looked at her and saw she was crying silently. Not a lot, but the tears were there. What we need is for someone to turn him off. 6. Alan returned to Castle Rock early the next morning, arriving home shortly before 2 o'clock. He crept into the house as quietly as possible, noticing that Annie had once again neglected to activate the burglar alarm. He didn't like to hassle her about it. Her migraines had become more frequent lately. But he supposed he would have to, sooner or later. He started upstairs, shoes held in one hand, moving with a smoothness that made him seem almost to float. His body possessed a deep grace, the exact opposite of Thad Beaumont's clumsiness, which Alan rarely showed. His flesh seemed to know some arcane secret of motion which his mind found somehow embarrassing. Now, in this silence, there was no need to hide it, and he moved with a shadowy ease that was almost macabre. Halfway up the stairs, he paused and went back down again. He had a small den off the living room, not much more than a broom closet furnished with a desk and some bookshelves, but adequate for his needs. He tried not to bring his work home with him. He did not always succeed in this, but he tried very hard. He closed the door, turned on the light, and looked at the telephone. "You're not really going to do this, are you?" he asked himself. "I mean, it's almost midnight, Rocky Mountain time, and this guy is not just a retired doctor. He's a retired neurosurgeon. You wake him up and he's apt to chew you a new asshole." Then Alan thought of Liz Beaumont's eyes, her dark, frightened eyes, and decided he was going to do it. Perhaps it would even do some good. A call in the dead of night would establish the fact that this was serious business and get Dr. Pritchard thinking. Then Alan would call him back at a more reasonable hour. Who knows? He thought without much hope, but with a trace of humor. Maybe he misses getting calls in the middle of the night. Alan took the scrap of paper from the pocket of his uniform blouse and dialed Hugh Pritchard's number in Fort Laramie. He did it standing up, setting himself for a blast of anger from that gravelly voice. He need not have worried. The answering machine cut in after the same fraction of a ring and delivered the same message. He hung up thoughtfully and sat down behind his desk. The gooseneck lamp cast a round circle of light on the desk's surface, and Alan began to make a series of shadow animals in its glow. A rabbit, a dog, a hawk, even a passable kangaroo. His hands possessed that same deep grace which owned the rest of his body when he was alone and at rest. Beneath those eerily flexible fingers, the animals seemed to march in a parade through the tiny spotlight cast by the hooded lamp, one flowing into the next. This little diversion had never failed to fascinate and amuse his children, and it often set his own mind at rest when it was troubled. It didn't work now. Dr. Hugh Pritchard is dead. Stark got him, too. That was impossible, of course. He supposed he could swallow a ghost if someone put a gun to his head, but not some malignant Superman of a ghost who crossed whole continents in a single bound. He could think of several good reasons why someone might turn on his answering machine at night. Not the least of them was to keep from being disturbed by late-calling strangers, such as Sheriff Alan J. Pangborn of Castle Rock, Maine. Yeah, but he's dead. He and his wife, too. What was her name? Helga. I'm probably playing golf. God knows what Helga's up to. But I know what Helga's up to. I know what you're both up to. You're up to your cutthroats in blood. That's what I think. And there's a message written on your living room wall out there in Big Sky Country. It says, "The sparrows are flying again." Alan Pangborn shuddered. It was crazy, but he shuddered anyway. It twisted through him like a wire. He dialed Wyoming Directory Assistance, got the number for the Fort Laramie Sheriff's Office, and made another call. He was answered by a dispatcher who sounded half asleep. Alan identified himself, told the dispatcher whom he had been trying to contact and where he lived, and then asked if they had Dr. Pritchard and his wife in their vacation file. If the doctor and his wife had gone off on holiday, and it was getting to be that season, they would probably have informed the local law and asked them to keep an eye on the house while it was empty. "Well," dispatch said, "why don't you give me your number? I'll call you back with the information." Alan sighed. This was just more standard operating procedure. More bullshit, not to put too fine a point on it. The guy didn't want to give out the information until he was sure Alan was what he said he was. "No," he said. "I'm calling from home, and it's the middle of the night." "It's not exactly high noon here, Sheriff Pangborn," dispatch answered laconically. Alan sighed. "I'm sure that's true," he said. "And I'm also sure that your wife and kids aren't asleep upstairs. Do this, my friend. Call the Maine State Police Barracks in Oxford, Maine. I'll give you the number and verify my name. They can give you my law's ID number. I'll call back in 10 minutes or so, and we can exchange passwords." "Shoot it to me," dispatch said, but he didn't sound happy about it. Alan guessed he might have taken the man away from the Late Show or maybe this month's penthouse. "What's this about?" dispatch asked after he had read back the Oxford State Police Barracks phone number. "Murder investigation," Alan said, "and it's hot. I'm not calling you for my health, pal." He hung up. He sat behind his desk and made shadow animals and waited for the minute hand to circle the face of the clock 10 times. It seemed very slow. It had only gone around 5 times when the study door opened and Annie came in. She was wearing her pink robe and looked somehow ghostly to him. He felt that shudder wanting to work through him again, as if he had looked into the future and seen something there which was unpleasant. Nasty, even. "How would I feel if it was me he was after?" he wondered suddenly. "Me and Annie and Toby and Todd. How would I feel if I knew who he was, and nobody would believe me? Alan, what are you doing, sitting down here so late?" He smiled, got up, kissed her easily. "Just waiting for the drugs to wear off," he said. "No, really. Is it this Beaumont business?" "Yeah. I've been trying to chase down a doctor who may know something about it. I keep getting his answering machine, so I call the sheriff's office to see if he's in their vacation file. The man on the other end is supposedly checking my bona fides." He looked at Annie with careful concern. "How are you, honey? Headache tonight?" "No," she said, "but I heard you come in." She smiled. "You're the world's quietest man when you want to be, Alan, but you can't do a thing about your car." He hugged her. "Do you want a cup of tea?" she asked. "God, no. A glass of milk, if you want to get one." She left him alone and came back a minute later with the milk. "What's Mr. Beaumont like?" she asked. "I've seen him around town, and his wife comes into the shop once in a while, but I've never spoken to him." The shop was You So-and-So, owned and operated by a woman named Polly Chalmers. Annie Pangborn had worked there part-time for 4 years. Alan thought about it. "I like him," he said at last. "At first I didn't. I thought he was a cold fish. But I was seeing him under difficult circumstances. He's just distant. Maybe it's because of what he does for a living." "I liked both of his books very much," Annie said. He raised his eyebrows. "I didn't know you'd read him." "You never asked, Alan. Then when the story broke about the pen name, I tried one of the other ones." Her nose wrinkled in displeasure. "No good?" "Terrible. Scary. I didn't finish it. I never would have believed the same man wrote both books. Guess what, babe? Alan thought. He doesn't believe it either. You ought to get back to bed, he said, or you'll wake up with another pounder. She shook her head. I think the headache monster's gone again, at least for a while. She gave him a look from beneath lowered lashes. I'll still be awake when you come up, if you're not too long, that is. He cupped one breast through the pink robe and kissed her parted lips. I'll be up just as fast as I can. She left, and Alan saw that more than 10 minutes had passed. He called Wyoming again and got the same sleepy dispatcher. Thought you'd forgot me, my friend. Not at all, Alan said. Mind giving me your laws number, Sheriff? 109-44-205-ME. I guess you're the genuine article, all right. Sorry to put you through this rigmarole so late, Sheriff Pangborn, but I guess you understand. I do. What can you tell me about Dr. Pritchard? Oh, he and his wife are in the vacation file, all right, Dispatch said. They're in Yellowstone Park, camping, until the end of the month. There, Alan thought. You see? You're down here jumping at shadows in the middle of the night. No cutthroats, no writing on the wall. Just two old folks on a camping trip. But he was not much relieved, he found. Dr. Pritchard was going to be a hard man to get hold of, at least for the next couple of weeks. If I needed to get a message to the guy, do you think I could do it? Alan asked. I'd think so, Dispatch said. You could call Park Services at Yellowstone. They'll know where he is, or they should. It might take a while, but they'd probably get him for you. I've met him a time or two. He seems like a nice enough old fella. Well, that's good to know, Alan said. Thanks for your time. Don't mention it. It's what we're here for. Alan heard the faint rattle of pages and could imagine this faceless man picking up his penthouse again, half a continent away. Good night, he said. Good night, Sheriff. Alan hung up and sat where he was for a moment, looking out the small den window into the darkness. He is out there, somewhere, and he's still coming. Alan wondered again how he would feel if it were his own life and the lives of Annie and his children at stake. He wondered how he would feel if he knew that and no one would believe what he knew. You're taking it home with you again, dear, he heard Annie say in his mind. And it was true. 15 minutes ago, he had been convinced, in his nerve endings, if not in his head, that you and Helga Pritchard were lying dead in a pool of blood. It wasn't true. They were sleeping peacefully under the stars in Yellowstone National Park tonight. So much for intuition. It had a way of just fading out on you. This is the way Thad's going to feel when we find out what's really going on, he thought. When we find out that the explanation, as bizarre as it may turn out to be, conforms to all the natural laws. Did he really believe that? Yes, he decided. He really did. In his head, at least. His nerve endings were not so sure. Alan finished his milk, turned off the desk lamp, and went upstairs. Annie was still awake, and she was gloriously naked. She folded him into her arms, and Alan gladly allowed himself to forget everything else. 7. Stark called again 2 days later. Thad Beaumont was in Dave's Market at the time. Dave's was a mom-and-pop store a mile and a half down the road from the Beaumont house. It was a place to go when running to the supermarket in Brewer was just too much of a pain in the ass. Thad went down that Friday evening to get a six-pack of Pepsi, some chips, and some dip. One of the troopers watching over the family rode with him. It was June 10th, 6:30 in the evening, plenty of light left in the sky. Summer, that beautiful green bitch, had ridden into Maine again. The cop sat in the car while Thad went in. He got his soda and was inspecting the wild array of dips. You had your basic clam, and if you didn't like that, you had your basic onion, when the telephone rang. He looked up at once, thinking, oh, okay. Rosalie behind the counter picked it up, said hello, listened, then held the phone out to him, as he had known she would. He was again swallowed by that dreamy feeling of presque vu. Telephone, Mr. Beaumont. He felt quite calm. His heart had stumbled over a beat, but only one. Now it was jogging along at its usual rate. He was not sweating, and there were no birds. He felt none of the fear and fury he'd felt 3 days earlier. He didn't bother asking Rosalie if it was his wife wanting him to pick up a dozen eggs or maybe a carton of OJ while he was here. He knew who it was. He stood by the Megabucks computer with its bright green screen announcing there had been no winner last week, and this week's lottery jackpot was $4 million. He took the phone from Rosalie and said, "Hello, George."
"Hello, Thad."
The soft brush stroke of southern accent was still there, but the overlay of country bumpkin was entirely gone. Thad only realized how strongly, yet subtly, Stark had managed to convey that feeling of,
"Hail fire, boys. I ain't too bright, but I sure did get away with it, didn't I? Yuck, yuck, yuck,"
when he heard its complete absence here. But of course now it's just the boys, Thad thought. Just a couple of white novelists standing around talking.
"What do you want?" "You know the answer to that. There's no need for us to play games, is there? It's a little bit late for that.
Maybe I just want to hear you say it out loud." That feeling was back, that weird feeling of being sucked out of his body and pulled down the telephone line to some place precisely between the two of them. Rosalie had taken herself down to the far end of the counter, where she was removing packs of cigarettes from a pile of cartons and restocking the long cigarette dispenser. She was ostentatiously not listening to Thad's end of the conversation in a way that was almost funny. There was no one in Ludlow, this end of town anyway, who wasn't aware that Thad was under police guard or police protection or police some damn thing, and he didn't have to hear the rumors to know they had already begun to fly. Those who didn't think he was about to be arrested for drug trafficking no doubt believed it was child abuse or wife beating. Poor old Rosalie was down there trying to be good, and Thad felt absurdly grateful. He also felt as if he were looking at her through the wrong end of a powerful telescope. He was down the telephone line, down the rabbit hole, where there was no white rabbit but only foxy old George Stark, the man who could not be there but somehow was all the same. Foxy old George, and down here in Ennsville, all the sparrows were flying again. He fought the feeling, fought hard.
"Go on, George," he said,
a little surprised by the rough edge of fury in his voice. He was dazed, caught in a powerful undertow of distance and unreality. But God, he sounded so awake and aware.
"Say it right out loud, why don't you?"
"If you insist."
"I do."
"It's time to start a new book, a new Stark novel."
"I don't think so."
"Don't say that."
The edge in that voice was like a whiplash loaded with tiny pellets of shot.
"I've been drawing you a picture, Thad. I've been drawing it for you. Don't make me draw it on you."
"You're dead, George. You just don't have the sense to lie down."
Rosalie's head turned a little. Thad glimpsed one wide eye before she turned hurriedly back to the cigarette racks again.
"You just watch your mouth."
Real fury in that voice. But was there something more? Was there fear? Pain? Both? Or was he only fooling himself?
"What's wrong, George?" he jeered suddenly. "Are you losing some of your happy thoughts?"
There was a pause then. That had surprised him, thrown him off stride, at least momentarily. Thad was sure of that. But why? What had done it?
"Listen to me, Buddy Roo," Stark said at last. "I'll give you a week to get started. Don't think you can bullshit me because you can't."
Except the last word was really can't.
Yes, George was upset.
It might cost Thad a great deal before this was over, but for the time being he felt only savage gladness. He had gotten through. It seemed he was not the only one that felt helpless and dreamily vulnerable during these nightmarishly intimate conversations. He had hurt Stark, and that was utterly fine. Thad said,
"That much is true. There's no bullshit between us. Whatever else there may be, there's none of that."
"You got an idea," Stark said. "You had it before that damn kid even thought about blackmailing you. The one about the wedding and the armored car score."
"I threw away my notes. I'm done with you."
"No, those were my notes you threw away, but it doesn't matter. You don't need notes. It'll be a good book."
"You don't understand. George Stark is dead."
"You're the one don't understand,"
Stark replied. His voice was soft, deadly, emphatic.
"You got a week. And if you haven't got at least 30 pages of manuscript, I'll be coming for you, Hoss. Only it won't start with you. That'd be too easy. That'd be entirely too easy. I'll take your kids first, and they will die slow. I'll see to it. I know how. They won't know what's happening, only that they're dying in agony.
But you'll know, and I'll know, and your wife will know. I'll take her next. Only before I take her, I'll take her. You know what I mean, old hoss. And when they're gone, I'll do you, Thad, and you'll die like no man on earth ever died before.
He stopped. Thad could hear him panting harshly in his ear, like a dog on a hot day.
You didn't know about the birds, Thad said softly. That much is true, isn't it?
Thad, you're not making sense. If you don't start pretty soon, a lot of people are going to get hurt. Time is running out.
Oh, I'm paying attention, Thad said. What I'm wondering is how you could have written what you did on Clausen's wall and then on Miriam's and not know about it.
You better stop talking trash and start making sense, my friend, Stark said.
But Thad could sense bewilderment and some rough fear just under the surface of that voice.
There wasn't anything written on their walls.
Oh, yes. Yes, there was.
And you know what, George? I think maybe the reason you don't know about that is because I wrote it. I think part of me was there. Somehow part of me was there watching you. I think I'm the only one of us who knows about the sparrows, George. I think maybe I wrote it.
You want to think about that. Think about it hard before you start pushing me.
Listen to me, Stark said with gentle force. Hear me real good. First your kids, then your wife, then you. Start another book, Thad. It's the best advice I can give you. Best advice you ever got in your damn life. Start another book. I'm not dead.
A long pause. Then softly, very deliberately.
And I don't want to be dead. So you go home and you sharpen your pencils. And if you need any inspiration, think about how your little babies would look with their faces full of glass. There ain't no goddamn birds. Just forget about them and start writing.
There was a click.
Fuck you,
Thad whispered into the dead line and slowly hung up the phone. Chapter 17. Wendy takes a fall. 1. The situation would have resolved itself in some way or other, no matter what happened. Thad was sure of that. George Stark wasn't simply going to go away. But Thad came to feel, and not without justification, that Wendy's tumble from the stairs 2 days after Stark called him at Dave's Market set just what course the situation would take for good and all. The most important result was that it finally showed him a course of action. He had spent those 2 days in a sort of breathless lull. He found it difficult to follow even the most simple-minded TV program, impossible to read, and the idea of writing seemed roughly akin to the idea of faster-than-light travel. Mostly he wandered from one room to the next, sitting for a few moments, and then moving on again. He got under Liz's feet and on her nerves. She wasn't sharp with him about it, although he guessed she had to bite her tongue on more than one occasion to keep from giving him the verbal equivalent of a paper cut. Twice he set out to tell her about the second call from Stark, the one where Foxy George had told him exactly what was on his mind, secure in the knowledge that the line wasn't tapped and they were speaking privately. On both occasions he had stopped, aware that he could do nothing but upset her more. And twice he had found himself up in his study, actually holding one of those damned barrel pencils he had promised never to use again, and looking at a fresh cellophane-wrapped pile of the notebooks Stark had used to write his novels.
You've got an idea. The one about the wedding and the armored car score.
And that was true. Thad even had a title, a good one. Steel Machine. Something else was true, too. Part of him really wanted to write it. That itch was there, like that one place on your back you can't quite reach when you need to scratch.
George would scratch it for you.
Oh, yes, George would be happy to scratch it for him, but something would happen to him, because things had changed now, hadn't they?
What exactly would that thing be?
He didn't know, perhaps couldn't know, but a frightening image kept recurring to him. It was that charming racist children's tale of yore, Little Black Sambo. When Black Sambo climbed the tree and the tigers couldn't get him, they became so angry that they bit each other's tails and raced faster and faster around the tree until they turned into butter. Sambo gathered the butter up in a crock and took it home to his mother.
George the Alchemist, Thad had mused, sitting in his study and tapping an unsharpened barrel Black Beauty against the edge of the desk. Straw into gold, tigers into butter,
books into bestsellers, and Thad into... what? He didn't know. He was afraid to know. But he would be gone. Thad would be gone. He was sure of that. There might be somebody living here who looked like him, but behind that Thad Beaumont face, there would be another mind. A sick, brilliant mind. He thought the new Thad Beaumont would be a good deal less clumsy and a good deal more dangerous. Liz and the babies? Would Stark leave them alone if he did make it into the driver's seat? Not him. He had considered running as well, packing Liz and the twins into the Suburban and just going. But what good would that do? What good when foxy old George could look out through dumb old Thad's eyes? It wouldn't matter if they ran to the end of the earth. They would get there, look around, and see George Stark mushing after them behind a team of huskies, his straight razor in his hand. He considered and, even more rapidly and decisively, dismissed the idea of calling Alan Pangborn. Alan had told them where Dr. Pritchard was, and his decision not to try to get a message through to the neurosurgeon, to wait until Pritchard and his wife returned from their camping trip, told Thad all he needed to know about what Alan believed, and, more important, what he did not believe. If he told Alan about the call he'd received in Dave's, Alan would think he was making it up. Even if Rosalie confirmed the fact that he had received a call from someone at the market, Alan would go on not believing. He and all the other police officers who had invited themselves to this particular party had a big investment in not believing. So the days passed slowly, and they were a kind of white time. Just after noon on the second day, Thad jotted, "I feel as if I'm in a mental version of the horse latitudes," in his journal. It was the only entry he had made in a week, and he began to wonder if he would ever make another one. His new novel, The Golden Dog, was sitting dead in the water. That, he supposed, went almost without saying. It was very hard to make up stories when you were afraid a bad man, a very bad man, was going to show up and slaughter your whole family before starting in on you. The only time he could recall being at such a loss with himself had been in the weeks after he had quit drinking. After he'd pulled the plug on the booze bath he'd wallowed in following Liz's miscarriage and before Stark appeared. Then, as now, there had been the feeling that there was a problem. But it was as unapproachable as one of those water mirages you see at the end of a flat stretch of highway on a hot afternoon. The harder he ran toward the problem, wanting to attack it with both hands, dismantle it, destroy it, the faster it receded, until he was finally left, panting and breathless, with that bogus ripple of water still mocking him at the horizon. These nights he slept badly, and dreamed George Stark was showing him his own deserted house, a house where things exploded when he touched them, and where, in the last room, the corpses of his wife and Frederick Clausen were waiting. At the moment he got there, all the birds would begin to fly, exploding upward from trees and telephone lines and electricity poles, thousands of them, millions of them, so many that they blotted out the sun. Until Wendy fell on the stairs, he felt very much like fool stuffing himself, just waiting for the right murderous somebody to come along, tuck a napkin into his collar, pick up his fork, and begin to eat. 2. The twins had been crawling for some time, and for the last month or so they had been pulling themselves up to a standing position with the aid of the nearest stable, or in some cases unstable, object. A chair leg was good, as was the coffee table, but even an empty cardboard carton would serve, at least until the twin in question put too much weight on it and it crumpled inward or turned turtle. Babies are capable of getting themselves into divine messes at any age, but at the age of 8 months, when crawling has served its purpose and walking has not quite been learned, they are clearly in the golden age of messmaking. Liz had set them out on the floor to play in a bright patch of sun around 4:45 in the afternoon. After 10 minutes or so of confident crawling and shaky standing, the latter accompanied by lusty crows of accomplishment to their parents and to each other, William pulled himself up on the edge of the coffee table. He glanced around and made several imperious gestures with his right arm. These gestures reminded Thad of old news films showing Il Duce addressing his constituency from his balcony. Then William seized his mother's teacup and managed to pour the lees all over himself before toppling backward onto his bottom. The tea was fortunately cold, but William held onto the cup and managed to wrap it against his mouth smartly enough to make his lower lip bleed a little. He began to wail. Wendy promptly joined in. Liz picked him up, examined him, rolled her eyes at Thad, and took him upstairs to soothe him and then clean him up.
"Keep an eye on the princess," she said as she went.
"I will," Thad said. But he had discovered and would shortly rediscover that, in the golden age of messmaking, such promises often amount to little. William had managed to snatch Liz's teacup from under her very nose, and Thad saw that Wendy was going to fall from the third stair riser just a moment too late to save her the tumble. He had been looking at a news magazine, not reading it, but thumbing idly through it, glancing every now and then at a picture. When he was finished, he went over to the large knitting basket by the fireplace, which served as a sloppy sort of magazine rack, to put it back and get another. Wendy was crawling across the floor, her tears forgotten before they were entirely dry on her chubby cheeks. She was making the breathy little rum-rum-rum sound both of them uttered when crawling, a sound that sometimes made Thad wonder if they associated all movement with the cars and trucks they saw on TV. He squatted, put the magazine on top of the pile in the basket, and thumbed through the others, finally selecting a month-old Harper's for no particular reason. It occurred to him that he was behaving quite a bit like a man in a dentist's office waiting for a tooth extraction. He turned around and Wendy was on the stairs. She had crawled up to the third one and was now rising shakily to her feet, holding onto one of the spindles which ran between the rail of the banister and the floor. As he looked at her, she spied him and gave a particularly grandiloquent arm gesture and a grin. The sweep of her arm sent her chubby body swaying forward over the short drop. "Jesus," he said under his breath, and as he rose to his feet, knees popping dryly, he saw her take a step forward and let go of the spindle. "Wendy, don't do that!" He nearly leaped across the room and almost made it. But he was a clumsy man, and one of his feet caught on the leg of the armchair. It fell over, and Thad went sprawling. Wendy fell outward and forward with a startled little squawk. Her body turned slightly in midair. He grabbed for her from his knees, trying to make a saving catch, and missed by a good 2 feet. Her right leg struck the first stair riser, and her head struck the carpeted floor of the living room with a muffled thud. She screamed, and he had time to think how terrifying a baby's cry of pain is, and then he had swept her into his arms. Overhead, Liz called out, "Thad?" in a startled voice, and he heard the thump-thump of her slippered feet running down the hall. Wendy was trying to cry. Her first yell of pain had expelled all but the tidal air from her lungs, and now came the paralyzing, eternal moment when she struggled to unlock her chest and draw in breath for the next whoop. It would bludgeon the eardrums when it finally came. If it came. He held her, looking anxiously into her twisted, blood-engorged face. It had gone a color which was almost puce, except for the red mark, like a very large comma on her forehead. God, what if she passes out? What if she strangles to death, unable to pull in breath and utter the cry locked in her flat little lungs? "Cry, damn it!" he shouted down at her. God, her purple face, her bulging, stricken eyes. "Cry!" "Thad!" Liz sounded very scared now, but she also seemed very distant. In those few eternal seconds between Wendy's first cry and her struggle to free the second one and so go on breathing, George Stark was driven totally out of Thad's mind for the first time in the last 8 days. Wendy drew in a great convulsive breath and began to whoop. Thad, trembling with relief, hugged her to his shoulder and began to stroke her back gently, making shushing sounds. Liz came pounding downstairs, a struggling William clasped against her side like a small bag of grain. "What happened? Thad, is she all right?"
"Yes. She took a tumble from the third stair up. She's fine now." "Once she started crying. At first it was like she just locked up."
He laughed shakily and traded Wendy for William, who was now bellowing in sympathetic harmony with his sister.
"Weren't you watching her?"
Liz asked reproachfully. She was automatically swinging her body back and forth at the hips, rocking Wendy, trying to soothe her.
"Yes. No. I went over to get a magazine. Next thing I knew, she was on the stairs. It was like Will and the teacup. They're just so damned eely. Is her head all right, do you think? She hit on the carpet, but she hit hard."
Liz held Wendy at arm's length for a moment, looked at the red mark, then kissed it gently. Wendy's sobs were already beginning to diminish in volume.
"I think it's okay. She'll have a bump for a day or two, that's all. Thank God for the carpet. I didn't mean to jump on you, Thad. I know how quick they are. I feel like I'm going to have my period, only it's all the time now."
Wendy's sobs were winding down to sniffles. Accordingly, William also began to dry up. He reached out a chubby arm and snatched at his sister's white cotton t-shirt. She looked around. He cooed, then babbled at her. To Thad, their babbling always sounded a little eerie, like a foreign language which had been speeded up just enough so you couldn't quite tell which one it was, let alone understand it. Wendy smiled at her brother, although her eyes were still streaming tears and her cheeks were wet with them. She cooed and babbled in reply. For a moment it was as if they were holding a conversation in their own private world. The world of twins. Wendy reached out and caressed William's shoulder. They looked at each other and went on cooing. "Are you all right, sweet one?"
"Yes, I hurt myself, dear William, but not badly."
"Will you want to stay home from the Stadley's dinner party, dear heart?"
"I should think not, although you are very thoughtful to ask."
"Are you quite sure, my dear Wendy?"
"Yes, darling William, no damage has been done, although I greatly fear I have shit in my diapers."
"Oh, sweetheart, how tiresome." Thad smiled a little, then looked at Wendy's leg. "That's going to bruise," he said. "In fact, it looks like it started already." Liz offered him a little smile.
"It will heal," she said, "and it won't be the last."
Thad leaned forward and kissed the tip of Wendy's nose, thinking how fast and how furiously these storms blew in. Not 3 minutes ago, he had been afraid she might die from lack of oxygen.
And how fast they blew back out again. "No," he agreed. "God willing, it won't be the last."
3. By the time the twins got up from their late naps at 7 that evening, the bruise on Wendy's upper thigh had turned a dark purple. It had an odd and distinctive mushroom shape.
"Thad," Liz said from the other changing table, "look at this."
Thad had removed Wendy's nap diaper, slightly dewy but not really wet, and dropped it into the diaper bucket marked hers. He carried his naked daughter over to his son's changing table to see what Liz wanted him to see. He looked down at William, and his eyes widened.
"What do you think?" she asked quietly.
"Is that weird or what?" Thad looked down at William for a long time.
"Yeah,"
he said at last.
"That's pretty weird."
She was holding their wriggling son on the changing table with a hand on his chest. Now she looked sharply around at Thad.
"Are you okay?"
"Yes," Thad said. He was surprised at how calm he sounded to himself. A large white light seemed to have gone off, not in front of his eyes, like a flash gun, but behind them. Suddenly he thought he understood about the birds, a little, and what the next step should be. Just looking down at his son and seeing the bruise on his leg, identical in shape, color, and location to the one on Wendy's leg, had made him understand that. When Will had grabbed Liz's teacup and upended it all over himself, he had sat down hard on his butt. So far as Thad knew, William hadn't done anything to his leg at all. Yet there it was, a sympathetic bruise on the upper thigh of his right leg, a bruise which was almost mushroom-shaped.
"You sure you're okay?" Liz persisted.
"They share their bruises, too," he said, looking down at William's leg.
"Thad?"
"I'm fine," he said, and brushed her cheek with his lips. "Let's get psycho and somatic dressed. What do you say?"
Liz burst out laughing.
"Thad, you're crazy," she said.
He smiled at her. It was a slightly peculiar, slightly distant smile.
"Yeah," he said. "Crazy like a fox."
He took Wendy back to her changing table and began to diaper her.
Chapter 18. Automatic Writing.
1. He waited until Liz had gone to bed before going up to his study. He paused outside their bedroom door for a minute or so on his way, listening to the regular ebb and flow of her breathing, assuring himself that she was asleep. He wasn't at all sure that what he was going to try would work, but if it did, it might be dangerous. Extremely dangerous. His study was one large room, a renovated barn loft, which had been divided into two areas. The reading room, which was a book-lined area with a couch, a reclining chair, and track lighting, and, at the far end of the long room, his work area. This part of the study was dominated by an old-fashioned business desk without a single feature to redeem its remarkable ugliness. It was a scarred, battered, uncompromisingly utilitarian piece of furniture. Thad had owned it since he was 26,
and Liz sometimes told people he wouldn't let it go because he secretly believed that it was his own private fountain of words. They would both smile when she said this, as if they really believed it was a joke. Three glass-shaded lights hung down over this dinosaur, and when Thad turned on only these lights, as he did now, the savage, overlapping circles of light they made on the desk's littered landscape made it seem as if he were about to play some strange version of billiards there. What the rules for play on such a complex surface might be, it was impossible to tell. But on the night after Wendy's accident, the tight set of his face would have convinced an observer that the game would be for very high stakes, whatever the rules. Thad would have agreed with that 100%. It had, after all, taken him over 24 hours to work his courage up to this. He looked at the Remington Standard for a moment, a vague hump under its cover with the stainless steel return lever sticking out from the left side like a hitchhiker's thumb. He sat down in front of it, drummed his fingers restlessly on the edge of the desk for a few moments, then opened the drawer to the left of the typewriter. This drawer was both wide and deep. He took his journal out of it, then opened the drawer all the way to its stop. The mason jar in which he kept the barrel black beauties had rolled all the way to the back, spilling pencils as it went. He took it out, set it in its accustomed place, then gathered up the pencils and put them back into it. He shut the drawer and looked at the jar. He had tossed it in the drawer after that first fugue, during which he had used one of the black beauties to write, "The sparrows are flying again," on the manuscript of the Golden Dog. He had never intended to use one again. Yet he had been fooling with one just a couple of nights ago, and here they were, sitting where they had sat during the dozen or so years when Stark had lived with him, lived in him. For long periods, Stark would be quiet, hardly there at all. Then an idea would strike, and foxy old George would leap out of his head like a crazed jack-in-the-box. Kapop! "Here I am, Thad. Let's go, old hoss. Saddle up." And every day for about 3 months thereafter, Stark would leap out promptly at 10 o'clock every day, weekends included. He would pop out, seize one of the barrel pencils, and commence writing his crazed nonsense. The crazed nonsense which paid the bills Thad's own work could not pay. Then the book would be done, and George would disappear again, like the crazy old man who had woven straw into gold for Rapunzel. Thad took out one of the pencils, looked at the teeth marks lightly tattooed on the wooden barrel, and then dropped it back into the jar. It made a tiny clink sound. "My dark half," he muttered. But was George Stark his? Had he ever been his? Except for the fugue or trance or whatever it had been, he had not used one of these pencils, not even to make notes, since writing "The End" at the bottom of the last page of the last Stark novel, "Riding to Babylon." There had been nothing to use them for, after all. They were George Stark's pencils, and Stark was dead, or so he had assumed. He supposed he would have gotten around to throwing them out in time, but now it seemed he had a use for them after all. He reached toward the wide-mouthed jar, then pulled his hand back, as if from the side of a furnace which glows with its own deep and jealous heat. "Not yet." He took the scripto pen from his shirt pocket, opened his journal, uncapped the pen, hesitated, and then wrote, "If William cries, Wendy cries. But I've discovered the link between them is much deeper and stronger than that. Yesterday, Wendy fell down the stairs and earned a bruise that looks like a big purple mushroom. When the twins got up from their naps, William had one too. Same location, same shape." Thad lapsed into the self-interview style which characterized a good part of his journal. As he did so, he realized this very habit, this way of finding a path to the things he really thought, suggested yet another form of duality. Or perhaps it was only another aspect of a single split in his mind and spirit, something which was both fundamental and mysterious. "Question. If you took slides of the bruises on my children's legs, then overlaid them, would you end up with what looked like a single image?" Answer. "Yes, I think you would. I think it is like the fingerprints. I think it is like the voice prints." Thad sat quietly for a moment, tapping the end of the pen against the journal page, considering this. Then he leaned forward again and began to write more quickly. "Question. Does William know he has a bruise?" Answer. "No, I don't think he does." "Question. Do I know what the sparrows are, or what they mean?" Answer. "No." question, but I do know there are sparrows. I know that much, don't I? Whatever Alan Pangborn or anyone else may believe, I know there are sparrows. And I know that they are flying again, don't I? Answer, yes. Now the pen was racing over the page. He had not written so quickly or unselfconsciously in months. Question, does Stark know there are sparrows? Answer, no, he said he doesn't, and I believe him. Question, am I sure I believe him? He stopped again briefly and then wrote, Stark knows there is something. But William must know there is something, too. If his leg is bruised, it must hurt. But Wendy gave him the bruise when she fell downstairs. William only knows he has a hurt place. Question. Does Stark know he has a hurt place, a vulnerable place? Answer. Yes, I think he does. Question. Are the birds mine? Answer. Yes. Question. Does that mean that when he wrote, The sparrows are flying again on Clausen's wall and Miriam's wall, he didn't know what he was doing and didn't remember it when he was done? Answer. Yes. Question. Who wrote about the sparrows? Who wrote it in blood? Answer. The one who knows. The one to whom the sparrows belong. Question. Who is the one who knows? Who owns the sparrows? Answer. I am the knower. I am the owner. Question. Was I there? Was I there when he murdered them? He paused again, briefly. Yes, he wrote, and then, no. Both. I didn't have a fugue when Stark killed either Homer Gamache or Clausen, at least not that I remember. I think that what I know, what I see, may be growing. Question. Does he see you? Answer. I don't know. But. He must, Thad muttered. He wrote, He must know me, he must see me. If he really did write the novels, he has known me for a long time. And his own knowing, his own seeing, is also growing. All that traceback and recording equipment didn't faze foxy old George a bit, did it? No, of course not. Because foxy old George knew it would be there. You don't spend almost 10 years writing crime fiction without finding out about stuff like that. That's one reason it didn't faze him. But the other one's even better, isn't it? When he wanted to talk to me privately, he knew exactly where I'd be and how to get hold of me, didn't he? Yes. Stark had called the house when he wanted to be overheard, and he had called Dave's Market when he didn't. Why had he wanted to be overheard in the first case? Because he had a message to send to the police he knew would be listening. That he wasn't George Stark, and knew he wasn't. And that he was done killing. He wasn't coming after Thad and Thad's family. And there was another reason, too. He wanted Thad to see the voice prints he knew they would make. He knew the police wouldn't believe their evidence, no matter how incontrovertible it seemed. But Thad would. Question. How did he know where I'd be? And that was a mighty good question, wasn't it? That was right up there with such questions as, how can two different men share the same fingerprints and voice prints? And how can two different babies have exactly the same bruise? Especially when only one of the babies in question happened to bump her leg. Except he knew that similar mysteries were well documented and accepted, at least in cases where twins were involved. The bond between identicals was even more eerie. There had been an article about it in one of the news magazines a year or so ago. Because of the twins in his own life, Thad had read the article closely. There was the case of identical twins who were separated by an entire continent. But when one of them broke his left leg, the other suffered excruciating pains in his own left leg without even knowing something had happened to his sib. There were the identical girls who had developed their own special language, a language known and understood by no one else on Earth. These twin girls had never learned English in spite of their identical high IQs. What need for English had they? They had each other, and that was all they wanted. And, the article said, there were the twins who, separated at birth, were reunited as adults and found they had both married on the same day of the same year women with the same first name and strikingly similar looks. Furthermore, both couples had named their first sons Robert. Both Roberts had been born in the same month and in the same year. Half and half, criss and cross, snick and snee.
Ike and Mike, they think alike, Thad muttered.
He reached out and circled the last line he had written.
Question. How did he know where I'd be?
Below this, he wrote,
Answer. Because the sparrows are flying again. And because we are twins.
He turned to a fresh page in his journal and laid the pen aside. Heart thumping hard, skin freezing with fear, he reached out a trembling right hand and pulled one of the barrel pencils from the jar. It seemed to burn with a low and unpleasant heat in his hand.
Time to go to work.
Thad Beaumont leaned over the blank page, paused, and then printed, The sparrows are flying again, in large block letters at the top. 2.
What exactly did he mean to do with the pencil?
But he knew that, too. He was going to try and answer the last question, the one so obvious he hadn't even bothered to write it down. Could he consciously induce the trance state? Could he make the sparrows fly? The idea embodied a form of psychic contact he had read about, but had never seen demonstrated. Automatic writing. The person attempting to contact a dead soul, or a living one, by this method, held a pen or pencil loosely in his hand with the tip on a blank sheet of paper and simply waited for the spirit, pun most definitely intended, to move him. Thad had read that automatic writing, which could be practiced with the aid of a Ouija board, was often approached as a kind of lark, a party game even, and that this could be extremely dangerous, that it could, in fact, lay the practitioner wide open to some form of possession. Thad had neither believed nor disbelieved this when reading it. It seemed as foreign to his own life as the worship of pagan idols or the practice of trepanning to relieve headaches. Now it seemed to have its own deadly logic, but he would have to summon the sparrows. He thought of them. He tried to summon up the image of all those birds, all those thousands of birds, sitting on roof peaks and telephone wires beneath a mild spring sky, waiting for the telepathic signal to take off. And the image came, but it was flat and unreal, a kind of mental painting with no life in it. When he began writing, it was often like this, a dry and sterile exercise. No, it was worse than that. Starting off always felt a little obscene to him, like French kissing a corpse. But he had learned that, if he kept at it, if he simply kept pushing the words along the page, something else kicked in, something which was both wonderful and terrible. The words as individual units began to disappear. Characters who were stilted and lifeless began to limber up, as if he had kept them in some small closet overnight, and they had to loosen their muscles before they could begin their complicated dances. Something began to happen in his brain. He could almost feel the shape of the electrical waves there changing, losing their prissy goose-step discipline, turning into the soft, sloppy delta waves of dreaming sleep. Now Thad sat hunched over his journal, pencil in hand, and tried to make this happen. As the moments spun themselves out and nothing did happen, he began to feel more and more foolish. A line from the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon show got into his head and refused to leave. Eeny, meeny, chilly, beeny. The spirits are about to speak. What in God's name was he going to say to Liz if she showed up and asked him what he was doing here with a pencil in his hand and a blank sheet of paper in front of him at just a few minutes before midnight? That he was trying to draw the bunny on the matchbook and win a scholarship to the famous artist school in New Haven? Hell, he didn't even have one of those matchbooks. He moved to put the pencil back, and then paused. He had turned in his chair a little, so he was looking out the window to the left of his desk. There was a bird out there, sitting on the window ledge and looking in at him with bright black eyes. It was a sparrow. As he watched, it was joined by another, and another. Oh, my God, he said in a trembling, watery voice. He had never been so terrified in his life, and suddenly that sensation of going filled him again. It was as it had been when he spoke to Stark on the telephone, but now it was stronger, much stronger. Another sparrow landed, jostling the other three aside for place, and beyond them he saw a whole line of birds sitting on top of the carriage house where they kept the lawn equipment and Liz's car. The antique weather vane on the carriage house's single gable was covered with them, swinging beneath their weight. Oh, my God, he repeated. And he heard his voice from a million miles away, a voice which was filled with horror and terrible wonder. Oh, my dear God, they're real. The sparrows are real. In all his imaginings, he had never suspected this.
but there was no time to consider it, no mind to consider it with. Suddenly the study was gone, and in its place he saw the Ridgeway section of Bergenfield where he had grown up. It lay as silent and deserted as the house in his stark nightmare. He found himself peering at a silent suburb in a dead world. Yet it was not entirely dead, because the roof of every house was lined with twittering sparrows. Every TV antenna was freighted with them. Every tree was filled with them. They queued upon every telephone line. They sat on the tops of parked cars, on the big blue mailbox which stood at the corner of Duke Street and Marlborough Lane, and on the bike rack in front of the Duke Street convenience store, where he had gone to buy milk and bread for his mother when he was a boy. The world was filled with sparrows, waiting for the command to fly. Thad Beaumont lolled back in his office chair, a thin froth spilling from the corners of his mouth, feet twitching aimlessly, and now all the windows of the study were lined with sparrows, looking in at him like strange avian spectators. A long gargling sound escaped his mouth. His eyes rolled up in his head, revealing bulging, glistening whites. The pencil touched the sheet and began to write. "Sis," it scrawled across the top line. It dropped two lines, made the L-shape indent mark that was characteristic of each new stark paragraph, and wrote, "L." The woman began to step away from the door. She did this almost at once, even before the door had stopped its short inward swing. But it was too late. My hand shot out through the 2-inch gap between the door and the jamb and clamped over her hand. The sparrows flew. All at once, they all took flight, the ones in his head from that long-ago Bergenfield and the ones outside his Ludlow home, the real ones. They flew up into two skies, a white spring sky in the year 1960 and a dark summer sky in the year 1988. They flew and they were gone in a ruffling blast of wings. Thad sat up, but his hand was still nailed to the pencil being pulled along. The pencil was writing by itself. "I made it," he thought dazedly, wiping spit and froth from his mouth and chin with his left hand. "I made it, and I wish to God I had let it alone. What is this?" He stared down at the words pouring out of his fist, his heart thumping so hard he felt the pulse high and fast in his throat. The sentences spilling out on the blue lines were in his own handwriting, but then all of Stark's novels had been written in his hand. With the same fingerprints, the same taste in cigarettes, and exactly the same vocal characteristics, it would be odder if it were someone else's handwriting, he thought. His handwriting, just as it had been all the other times, but where were the words coming from? Not from his own head, that was certain. There was nothing up there right now but terror overlaid with loud, roaring confusion. And there was no feeling in his hand anymore. His right arm seemed to end roughly 3 inches above his wrist. There was not even a remote sense of pressure in his fingers, although he could see he was gripping the barrel tightly enough to turn his thumb and first 2 fingers white at the tips. It was as if he had been given a healthy shot of Novocaine. He reached the bottom of the first sheet. His unfeeling hand tore it back. His unfeeling palm raced up the journal's binding, creasing the page flat, and began to write again. L. Miriam Colley opened her mouth to scream. I had been standing just inside the door, waiting patiently for just over 4 hours, not drinking coffee, not smoking cigarettes. I'd wanted one, and would have one as soon as it was over, but before, the smell might have alerted her. I reminded myself to close her eyes after cutting her throat. Thad realized with mounting horror that he was reading an account of Miriam Colley's murder. And this time it was not a broken, confused stew of words, but the coherent, brutal narration of a man who was, in his own horrid way, an extremely effective writer. Effective enough so that millions of people had bought his fiction. George Stark's non-fiction debut, he thought sickly. He had done exactly what he had set out to do. Had made contact, had somehow tapped into Stark's mind, just as Stark must somehow have tapped into Thad's own mind. But who would have guessed what monstrous unknown forces he would touch in doing so? Who could have guessed? The sparrows, and the realization that the sparrows were real, had been bad. But this was worse. Had he thought both the pencil and the notebook were warm to the touch? No wonder. This man's mind was a fucking furnace. And now, Jesus, here it was, unrolling out of his own fist. Jesus Christ! L.
You're thinking you could brain me with that thing, aren't you, sis? I asked her. Let me tell you something. That's not a happy thought. And you know what happens to people who lose their happy thoughts, don't you? L. The tears were running down her cheeks now.
What's wrong, George? Are you losing some of your happy thoughts?
No wonder it had stopped the black-hearted son of a bitch for a moment when he had said that. If this was the way it really had been, then Stark had used the same phrase before killing Miriam.
I was tapped into his mind during the murder. I was. That's why I used that phrase during the conversation we had at Dave's.
Here was Stark forcing Miriam to call Thad, dialing the number for her because she was too terrified to remember it, although there were weeks when she must have dialed it half a dozen times. Thad found this forgetfulness and Stark's understanding of it both horrible and persuasive. And now Stark was using his razor to... But he didn't want to read that, wouldn't read that. He pulled his arm up, lifting his numb hand along with it like a lead weight. The instant the pencil's contact with the notebook was broken, feeling flooded back into the hand. The muscles were cramped and the side of his second finger ached dully. The barrel of the pencil had left an indentation which was now turning red. He looked down at the scrawled page, full of horror and a dumb species of wonder. The last thing on earth he wanted to do was to put that pencil back down again, to complete that obscene circuit between Stark and himself again. But he hadn't gotten into this just to read Stark's first-hand account of Mir Collie's murder, had he? Suppose the birds come back. But they wouldn't. The birds had served their purpose. The circuit he had achieved was still whole and functioning. Thad had no idea how he knew that, but he did know. Where are you, George? He thought. How come I don't feel you? Is it because you are as unaware of my presence as I am of yours? Or is it something else? Where the fuck are you? He held the thought in the front of his mind, trying to visualize it as a bright red neon sign. Then he gripped the pencil again and began lowering it toward his journal. As soon as the tip of the pencil touched the paper, his hand rose again and flipped to a blank sheet. The palm flattened the turned sheet along the crease, as it had done once before. Then the pencil returned to the paper and wrote, L. It doesn't matter, Machine told Jack Rangeley. All places are the same. He paused. Except maybe home. And I'll know that when I get there. All places are the same. He recognized that line first, then the whole quote. It was from the first chapter of Stark's first novel, Machine's Way. The pencil had stopped of its own accord this time. He raised it and looked down at the scribbled words, cold and prickling. Except maybe home, and I'll know that when I get there. In Machine's Way, home had been Flatbush Avenue, where Alexis Machine had spent his childhood, sweeping up in the billiard parlor of his diseased alcoholic father. Where was home in this story? Where is home? He thought at the pencil, and slowly lowered it to the paper again. The pencil made a quick series of sloping M shapes. It paused, then moved again. L. Home is where the start is, the pencil wrote below the birds. A pun. Did it mean anything? Was the contact really still there? Or was he fooling himself now? He hadn't been fooling himself about the birds, and he hadn't been fooling himself during that first frenzied spate of writing. He knew that. But the feeling of heat and compulsion seemed to have abated. His hand still felt numb, but how tightly he was gripping the pencil, and that was very tightly indeed, judging from the mark on the side of his finger, could have something to do with that. Hadn't he read in that same piece on automatic writing that people often fooled themselves with the Ouija board? That in most cases it was guided not by the spirits, but by the subconscious thoughts and desires of the operator? Home is where the start is. If it was still Stark, and if the pun had some meaning, it meant here, in this house, didn't it? Because George Stark had been born here. Suddenly, part of the damned People magazine article floated into his mind. I rolled a sheet of paper into my typewriter, and then I rolled it right back out again. I've typed all my books, but George Stark apparently didn't hold with typewriters. Maybe because they didn't have typing classes in any of the stone hotels where he did time. Cute, very cute. But it had only a second cousinship with the actual facts, didn't it? It wasn't the first time Thad had told a story that had only a tenuous relationship to the truth, and he supposed it wouldn't be the last. Assuming he lived through this, of course. It wasn't exactly lying. It wasn't even embroidering the truth, strictly speaking. It was the almost unconscious act of fictionalizing one's own life, and Thad didn't know a single writer of novels or short stories who didn't do it. You didn't do it to make yourself look better than you'd actually been in any given situation. Sometimes that happened, but you were just as apt to relate a story that cast you in a bad light or made you look comically stupid. What was the movie where some newspaper man had said, "When you've got a choice between truth and legend, print the legend"? The man who shot Liberty Valance, maybe. It might make for shitty and immoral reporting, but it made for wonderful fiction. The overflow of make-believe into one's own life seemed to be an almost unavoidable side effect of storytelling, like getting calluses on the pads of your fingers from playing the guitar, or developing a cough after years of smoking. The facts of Stark's birth were actually quite different from the people version. There had been no mystic decision to write the Stark novels longhand, although time had turned it into a kind of ritual. And when it came to ritual, writers were as superstitious as professional athletes. Baseball players might wear the same socks day after day or cross themselves before stepping into the batter's box if they were hitting well. Writers, when successful, were apt to follow the same patterns until they became rituals in an effort to ward off the literary equivalent of a batting slump, which was known as writer's block. George Stark's habit of writing his novels longhand had begun simply because Thad forgot to bring any fresh ribbons for the Underwood in his little office at the summer house in Castle Rock. He'd had no typewriter ribbons, but the idea had been too hot and promising to wait, so he had rooted through the drawers of the little desk he kept down there until he found a notebook and some pencils and... "In those days, we used to get down to the place at the lake a lot later in the summer, because I taught that 3-week block course. What was it called? Creative Modes. Stupid damn thing. It was late June that year, and I remember going up to the office and discovering there weren't any ribbons. Hell, I remember Liz bitching that there wasn't even any coffee. Home is where the start is." Talking to Mike Donaldson, the guy from People magazine, telling the semi-fictional story of George Stark's genesis, he had switched the location to the big house here in Ludlow without even thinking about it, because he supposed Ludlow was where he did most of his writing, and it was perfectly normal to set the scene here. Especially if you were setting a scene, thinking of a scene, the way you did when you were making a piece of fiction. But it wasn't here that George Stark had made his debut. Not here that he had first used Thad's eyes to look out at the world. Although it was here that he had done most of his work, both as Stark and as himself. It was here that they lived most of their odd dual lives. Home is where the start is. In this case, home must mean Castle Rock. Castle Rock, which also happened to be the location of Homeland Cemetery. Homeland Cemetery, which was where, in Thad's mind, if not in Alan Pangborn's, George Stark had first appeared in his murderous physical incarnation about 2 weeks ago. Then, as if it were the most natural progression in the world, and for all he knew it might have been, another question occurred to him, one that was so basic and occurred so spontaneously that he heard himself mutter it aloud, like a shy fan at a Meet the Author tea. "Why do you want to go back to writing?" He lowered his hand until the tip of the pencil touched the paper. That numbness flowed back over it and into it, making it feel as if it were immersed in a stream of very cold, very clear water. Once more, the hand's first act was to rise again and turn to a fresh page in the journal. It came back down, creased the turned sheet flat. But this time the writing did not begin at once. Thad had time to think that the contact, whatever it was, had been broken in spite of the numbness. And then the pencil jerked in his hand as if it were a live thing itself, alive but badly wounded. It jerked, making a mark like a sleepy comma, jerked again, making a dash, and then wrote, "George Stark. George. George Stark. There are no birds. George Stark." Before coming to rest like a wheezy piece of machinery. Yes, you can write your name, and you can deny the sparrows. Very good. But why do you want to go back to writing? Why is it so important? Important enough to kill people? L. If I don't, I'll die, the pencil wrote.
What do you mean?
Thad muttered, but he felt a wild hope explode in his head. Could it possibly be that simple? He supposed that it could be, especially for a writer who had no business existing in the first place. Christ, there were enough real writers who couldn't exist unless they were writing, or felt they couldn't. And in the case of men like Ernest Hemingway, it really came down to the same thing, didn't it? The pencil trembled, then drew a long, scrawling line below the last message. It looked weirdly like the voice print.
Come on, Thad whispered. What the hell do you mean?
L. Falling apart, the pencil wrote. The letters were stilted, reluctant. The pencil jerked and wavered between his fingers, which were wax white.
If I exert much more pressure, Thad thought, it's just gonna snap off.
Losing necessary cohesion. L. There are no birds. There are no fucking birds. Oh, you son of a bitch, get out of my head. Suddenly his arm flew up. At the same time, his numb hand flicked the pencil with the agility of a stage magician manipulating a card, and instead of holding it between his fingers most of the way down its barrel, he was gripping the pencil in his fist like a dagger. He brought it down. Stark brought it down, and suddenly the pencil was buried in the web of flesh between the thumb and first finger of his left hand. The graphite tip, somewhat dulled by the writing Stark had done with it, passed almost all the way through it. The pencil snapped. A bright puddle of blood filled the depression the pencil's barrel had dragged into his flesh, and suddenly the force which had gripped him was gone. Red pain raved up from his hand, which lay on his desk with the pencil jutting out of it. Thad threw his head back and clamped his teeth shut against the agonized howl which fought to escape his throat.
End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.